This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and acknowledge the ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Colonisation and genocide are ongoing processes that are still continuing to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded, and this always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Auspol Snack Pod, the podcast where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian news and politics with a side of crispy memes. We're also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group, so if you like Auspol and shitposting, head over to Facebook, find us, join up. It'll be fun. I am one of your hosts, Zach Lesnack, a.k.a. one of Australia's foremost political nobodies, and with me, as always, is my friend, confidant and member of my inner sanctum.
Hey, I'm Noon. I am also one of Australia's foremost political nobodies. One of our close friends called us that, and I think we both really, really dug it.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll change up our intro, you know, weekly bite-sized chunks or whatever. I feel like Australia's foremost political nobodies is a good tagline.
I feel like it sums it up quite nicely. This is episode 50, which is a milestone, obviously, two episodes away from 1 year of Auspol Snack Pod, which is very exciting. Mm. And we plan on doing something very self-indulgent when that 1 year anniversary comes around. But yeah, just wanted to say up top, thank you to everybody who has supported us. It means so much. And, it is frankly ridiculous that we've been doing this long.
Absolutely.
And that people are still listening. So
when we first started, we were like, weekly is a bit too much. Maybe we can do fortnightly or monthly. And also we were like, maybe we'll do this for like, you know, 5 or 6 episodes and it'll probably fade out and that'll be fine. But it hasn't. It's gotten better and tighter and more fun and easier from our point of view, at least. And it sounds like from the feedback that we got from our many listeners and reviews this week, yeah, people have also been enjoying how we've been going. So thank you all for listening. Thank you all for supporting the show. Here's to another 50 episodes.
Damn straight. All right, Noon, you want to take us through our entree?
Sure. So this is two kind of brief stories, which are both good news about long-running legal cases. Neither of them are kind of over and done with yet, but they're both big steps in what I think are the right direction. So the first one, which is significantly heavier than the other, is about Malka Leifer, who we've talked about before. She's an alleged pedophile principal from a school in Melbourne. In 2008, she was confronted by the school board, who said they weren't going to call the police, but that she should fly to Israel that night, which she did. She was basically on the lam in Israel for 10 years. She was arrested in 2018 by Israeli police, and she's been fighting extradition ever since. Extradition to Australia, that is. She's had 67 court hearings, which have been about she's been trying to avoid going to an extradition trial. And so these 67 court hearings, she's been saying she's psychologically distraught. She's got all of these mental problems and whatever. She's been having psychiatric evaluations. And then when they found that she's fine, she's been getting other psychiatric evaluations and whatever, whatever. So now this has been happening for 2 years, since 2018. And she's finally been mentally fit to stand trial, which is really good news. Some of her victims spoke about it and said that it was just amazing news. She's now going to stand trial in Israel to find out if she'll be extradited to Australia. And it's likely that she will be found that she does need to be extradited. And regardless of the outcome, she's definitely going to appeal, which has been her sort of like approach to this whole process so far, is just like slow it down with legal bullshit as much as possible. Mm. So it's still not resolved, but it is moving forward. And the other thing is, once she gets here, she'll have to stand trial. So it's a small but very significant step forward in this story.
For sure.
And the other one, which is a lot more, I don't know, fun's quite the right word, but it's definitely, you know, easier, is about the letters between Sir John Kerr and the Queen at the time of the Whitlam dismissal. And as long-term listeners will know, I have a strong opinions about this whole situation, so this is very exciting for me.
No.
So, thank you. Professor Jenny Hocking is a political scientist and writer, and she has a bunch of academic titles, but my favorite one is from racist scrotum journalist Jared Henderson, who called her, quote, the official historian of the Australian left, which is also in her Twitter bio, which I think is very funny from Jared Henderson.
That's better than, even better than Australia's foremost political nobodies.
Totally. She's a foremost political somebody.
Somebody.
Yeah. Anyway, she's been suing the Commonwealth to make them release the Palace Letters, which are these 211 letters that Governor-General Sir John Kerr exchanged with the Queen in the year or so around the Whitlam dismissal. And these letters have been held by the National Archives in Canberra, but they haven't been available to the public because the Queen has embargoed them on the basis that they're personal correspondence, right? That they're, like, not state business. It was just her writing to her friend, which supports my hot take that the Queen was only ever advising Sir John Kerr, but anyway, that's fine. So the High Court, this case has been before the courts for ages, and the High Court finally found that they weren't personal correspondence, they were state business, and that the National Archives must reconsider their refusal to publish them.
No, come on. Like, a head of state and her representative, that's just...
No, a head of state and the Queen.
My bad. Exchange, it's just, they're pen pals. Like, exactly. Why are you going to pry? Come on.
Oh, they're discussing removing the Prime Minister and the legal and, like, political ramifications of that.
It's about a personal disagreement between friends. Yeah. They all know each other.
Anyway, Director General of the National Archives is a guy called David Fricker, and he said his organization was, quote, pro-disclosure. And he said, we operate on the basis that a Commonwealth record should be made publicly available unless there's a specific and compelling need to withhold it, and we work extremely hard to do this for the Australian people.
A compelling need, a.k.a. I don't really want to.
Well, when the Queen says she doesn't really want to, it is a bit hard for a, like, random public civil servant to be like, fuck you, Queenie. But I mean, I would personally, but I'm not in any position of power, so that's fine. Anyway, so it sounds like he's pretty keen to release them, so that's good news. And now that this court case has found that there's no good reason not to, basically, it sounds like he's being like, yeah, we're going to do that. So watch this space. Very exciting stuff.
Thanks for that tasty entree, Noon. Little double serving entree. Appreciate it. Now it's time for...
You fucked up.
Feels maybe a little bit flippant to use that sting for this particular news story, but also...
not inaccurate.
Yeah, and, like, also, this is sometimes quite a flippant show discussing flippant issues, so I guess it's probably a little bit too late for me to be worried about that. But anyway, who fucked up was the government and Services Australia, aka the people who run Centrelink, because they have to pay back $721 million that they made Centrelink recipients pay through the robo-debt auto-generated debt system. So over 600,000 of these robo-debt notices were sent out. Some people received multiple notices. I think it was 370,000 people, roughly, Whoa. That were affected. So this is, like, a huge chunk of the population.
Yep.
So I've got the word debts here in, like... written in
heavy
the notes.
Quotation marks.
Yeah, like 8 quotation marks, because in, like, describing these robo-debt notices as debts is not accurate in many cases, because a lot of the time people didn't owe the government anything. But anyway, these debts will be not waived, but zeroed by the government. Huh. Yeah, so they could theoretically pursue these people for money in the future. They're leaving the door open for themselves.
Right.
But so, you know, some of that money is going to be refunds for people who have already paid, others of it is just going to be people be them acknowledging, oh, no, you never owed us money. How bad. And just as a bit of a tangent, this news was released on Friday afternoon, 15 minutes after Scott Morrison had done a completely unrelated press conference, and it was only announced like half an hour before the government services minister gave a press conference about it. So it's like... yeah, the government doing the classic tactic of trying to bury it late on a Friday, which is just like, it's just hilarious to me that that's a thing that just happens consistently. Like that like everybody can't see how fucking transparently they're trying to bury something.
It's also like a tactic from a pre-internet era. Like, no doubt it does work to a certain extent still, but like. People have the fucking internet and phones, dude. Like,
we are
checking the news on a Friday night. Like, it's...
and, like, on a Saturday morning, like, I'm gonna...
yeah.
I'm not at work. I've got more time. I mean, let's be honest. I'm on the news a lot at work. But when I don't have to pretend to be working, I can read even more news. So, look, just as a little bit of a refresher, so the RoboDebt was a system that was brought in to check the income of Centrelink recipients, the reported income, to make sure, like, because of, you know, over a certain amount, if you earn over a certain amount, your Centrelink payments start to get reduced. And so the system that we're using to do this was automatically checking averaged income data from the Australian Tax Office against the income that people were reporting to Centrelink themselves, which basically, you know, putting all these decisions in the hands of an algorithm and instead of humans, and also put the burden of proof on the recipients of these debt notices to prove that they didn't owe the debt. Which
the
is
the other thing is, or as you already said, it was averaged tax office income data against the weekly reported income or monthly reported income. So it people would like have earned a certain amount of money in a couple of months early in the year and then not for the rest of the year and have been getting Centrelink, and they would have reported it appropriately and not have been eligible for a cut later in the year. And yeah, it's like comparing apples and oranges or subtracting apples from oranges and being like, you owe us the difference.
Yeah, it's extremely fucked and broken. And in fact, well, I'll get into it shortly, but illegal. So, obviously, this resulted in a whole bunch of debt notices being issued to people who didn't owe the government anything. Some people had their tax returns seized. Others had to pay a 10% recovery fee on top of the quote-unquote debts. and we're talking about people here who are already having to subsist on an income that is below the poverty line provided by the government, to whom receiving like a debt notice for say $300 is fucking devastating.
Huge. Yeah, yeah.
And there were, you know, so the emotional and psychological fallout of this was absolutely massive and basically incalculable. We know that there are several suicides that were directly linked to people receiving robo debt notices, but you know, obviously, like this is inflicted so much more stress and hardship on people who are already doing it so tough, you know, who are already being ground down deliberately by the government because this country just hates poor people so much. But anyway, so when this announcement was made by the government services minister and avid surfer of the net, Stuart Roberts, you might remember him for his internet bill that was in the dozens of thousands. He didn't apologize. It's worth noting that he was the services minister when the RoboDebt scheme was first conceived in 2015 as well. So he's like very squarely behind this whole thing. He said at the press conference, quote, "The best advice we have is that raising a debt wholly or partly on the basis of ATO averaged income is not sufficient under the law.
No shit.
Therefore, we will return that money and move forward with our income compliance program." So he wants RoboDebt to continue.
Right.
Just basically not using the ATO averaged data.
Using a different algorithm. Or,
yes.
Yeah, different input.
But actually, and some more reporting has come out just this morning from Luke Enriquez Gomez in The Guardian, and he's been following this story and doing absolutely fantastic work on it basically since the scheme was introduced. And he reported that he'd seen leaked advice from Services Australia who had told Cabinet in February that RoboDebt was, quote, no longer viable or effective. So the government's known about this for a while, and I'm pretty sure it was Anne Rustin, Stuart Robert himself, and also Christian Porter who all saw this advice. So these people have been, they've been sitting on this for a while.
Also, like, people, I realize it's not the same coming from, like, schmoes who are lefties or whatever, but, like, people have been saying that this was going to be illegal for a long time. They probably already knew this, but were like, oh, fuck it. And then when Services Australia told them, they were like, oh, no.
Yes. And this leaked advice also showed that Services Australia had gotten legal advice themselves that said that they can't use bank statements in lieu of payslips instead.
Good.
So how they're going to continue doing RoboDebt without using ATO average data or bank statements remains to be seen, but Stuart Roberts is obviously pretty committed to breathing a little bit of extra life into this flaccid corpse of a scheme. But so the other bit of context that's important to mention around this is that there is a class action developing against the government for you know, Centrelink recipients, people who received these RoboDebt notices. So 12,000 people have signed up
Including several of our listeners.
Including several of our listeners. And Centrelink was instructed by the court to issue over 400,000 notices to everybody who could potentially be a claimant. So this is this class action is being set up by Gordon Legal.
Is that and Slater and Gordon?
I meant to look up exactly what their relationship to Slater and Gordon is. Gotcha. We can assume that they're an arm,
a subpart of it, or whatever. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. But so they're demanding not just a refund, but also damages and interest on the money that people paid to the government under the RoboDebt scheme. So it's, you know, very convenient now that the government is like, oh yeah, we're refunding everything immediately and giving everybody their money back. And then everyone
to like ask us for damages.
Yeah. And depending on how it's organized, it may, like, people getting their money back could possibly be dependent on them excluding themselves from a class action or any further legal action against the government. And also, completely unrelated news, and I don't even know why I put this in here, but the government is apparently planning an inquiry into class actions in Australia.
Huh.
Just so nefarious.
Totally.
So fucking nefarious, these people. So, look. People have died. People have suffered immeasurable harm under this scheme. The government has not apologized. Giving the money back is not going to bring those people back or undo the harm that this scheme did. And it did its job very effectively, which was to punish poor people and to discourage everybody else from ever possibly going on welfare. So it's really, really awful stuff. But look, it is a small victory. It's a step in the right direction. And I think credit needs to go to the activists who have been doing a whole bunch of work on this, the Australian Unemployed Workers Union, especially, and also the activist Asher Wolf, who has been doing like just a huge amount of advocacy around this. And I wanted to round this section out with a couple of tweets from her in response to this. So she says, "There were thousands of people involved in the campaign against RoboDebt, but for the first 18 months, a group of grassroots campaigners slogged uphill to change the narrative around unemployment. The outcome today is neither victory or justice until damages are paid on top of repayment of false debts. We can't bring back the dead, can't heal all the wounds inflicted by RoboDebt, but we can change both government policy and the government as well if they refuse to change. The most important thing you can do right now to change the rules in this country is to join and or donate to Oz Unemployment. Help them win adequate social security rights for all who need it." So she's referring to AUWU there, which I highly recommend everybody donating to or getting involved with if you can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a horrible story, but at least it's a bit of good news. Speaking of horrible stories but good news, maybe we can move on to
Shitpost of the Week.
We've got two shitposts of the week this week, and they're both... Zach was originally reluctant about them because he felt like they were maybe a little bit self-centered or something. But these are two memes made by two long-standing friends of the show about our landlord cop story last week. So you may remember the story about the cop who was a landlord who defrauded a bunch of people.
I would just like to point out here as well that once again, Australia's foremost political nobodies were right on the money. When we discussed the story of landlord cop last week, we said up top, the snack pack, they're going to fucking love this shit. They're gonna eat this shit up. And lo and behold, the shit posts came raining down. So that's another one to chalk up in the Got It Right books.
Yep.
Of which I think there's about three ticks in that column at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. We don't even have a Get It Wrong book. That's just like a...
that's just our
a
show.
Just a ticker going on. Yeah. Okay, so this first meme is from a friend, confidant, member of our inner sanctum, Holly, and it is a screenshot from Parks and Rec, and it's of Ben Wyatt, who I am Ben Wyatt. You know, a lot of people have said that. It's depressingly
high
true.
High praise.
I really want to play the winds of... whatever
the,
it is.
The board game that he invents?
The board game that he makes, yeah. The cones of something, whatever, yeah. Okay, and so it's him looking extremely disheveled and unshaven, and he's saying, do you think a depressed cop could make this? And holding something out, and what he's holding out is energetically and fraudulently managed property portfolio. So, yeah, it's very
which, if you don't get that joke, please go back and listen to last week's episode to get the full story on Landlord Cop. The Snack Pack's latest obsession. The other shitpost of the week winner that we wanted to shout out was this one is one from Steph Westwood. As Noon said, a long-standing friend, confidant, and member of Snack Pod's Inner Sanctum. And it's a friendship ended with meme, which is very excellent. We've got a picture of Landlord Cop, a.k.a. Rosa Rossi, I'm pretty sure her name is. Friendship ended with appropriate ways of dealing with depression. Now, a large investment property portfolio is my best friend. And they've got two pictures here crossed out, one of medication and one of counseling, and just posted up a big pic of stonks going up above a bunch of houses. It's an extremely good meme. Great work, Steph.
Yeah, it's really good, Steph. And I love this format, and I just love the many details and the remix of it. It's just great. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you, Holly. Thank you, Steph. Both second time, maybe even third time shitpost of the week winners. Yeah, at least second for each. So good job, both
couple
of you.
Of
thank you for...
Crack shot shit posters. Couple of crack posters.
Not sure crack shot or crack posting is exactly right, but sure. Okay.
All right. Well, moving on, I guess. So most of what the rest of the episode is going to be discussing is a few different stories about First Nations people. The first thing that we wanted to talk about was Sorry Day, which was earlier this week on the 26th of May. And just a warning that this segment is going to contain the sounds of a person who has died, an Aboriginal person who has died. So if you want to skip through this section, we will put a time code in the show notes for you to forward on. But so Sorry Day marks the anniversary of the Bringing Them Home report, which was tabled in 1997. So that's the inquiry into the Stolen Generations. Sorry Day is the day before Reconciliation Week starts on this 27th of May, which is the anniversary of the 1967 referendum, which allowed Aboriginal people to be counted in the census. And Reconciliation Week ends with the anniversary of the Mabo ruling on the 3rd of June in 1992, which is when the High Court ruled that terra nullius was void in Australia and recognised that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have rights to the land, which existed before British arrival. Mm. 1992 was when we figured that out. I've got a quote here, a few little bits and pieces that I've pulled from different places on the internet that just to kind of, I suppose, I don't know, rather than giving my personal perspective on this, I thought it might be good to just read a few quotes from Indigenous writers. And I've got one here from Karen Wild, a writer of Matu descent, from an article that she wrote in Indigenous X called Sorry Day, What Needs to Be Said. She says, for most of the 20th century, Aboriginal children were removed for a number of reasons. For their own good was not one of them. Once removed, Aboriginal children were given a very, very basic education. The girls were trained to be domestics and the boys as labourers. Some of these children were sent out to work on stations and in non-Indigenous people's houses when they were barely adolescents. Those who benefited from their services often paid government authorities for this labour or the church-run institutions where the children had previously been held. And I just wanted to read that because I just think that it's important to remember exactly what we're talking about here when we're talking about the Stolen Generation and Sorry Day, that we just, you know, that I sometimes when I read something about the Stolen Generations and what in the kind of contemporary response to it, it sort of glosses over exactly what actually went on. And I just think it's important that we keep that front of mind at you know, when we're supposed to be thinking about that and reflecting on it.
I think also there's something there about like, In Australia, I feel like it's easier for white Australia to distance ourselves from the stuff that we did to our First Nations people, especially compared to like how Americans treated black people. And like in Australia, we didn't have plantations, but we did have fucking cattle stations. And we didn't have the transatlantic slave trade, but we had slaves. And this is an example of that, you know, they were quote unquote laborers, but they were not being paid for their labor. That's a fucking slave. And I don't know. I think also in this week, when I think a lot of people are thinking about George Floyd's death in the United States and the protests about that, there's been a bit of discussion about, like, well, what is the police violence situation in Australia like? And we're not really talking about police violence here. But yeah, I just think it's worth remembering that we have done all the same things that the Americans did and that we're still doing them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not to distance ourselves from those things.
No, and I do think that there's an element of, as you say, like denial or distancing that that happens when people become very sort of obsessed with race politics happening in the United States.
Yes.
Instead of looking inwards, as you say, we've just got, you know, the situation here is seriously fucking awful. And as Karen Wilde points out there, you know, the government authorities and churches were being paid for these, you know, indentured servants, basically, that they made of young Indigenous people. And those are the institutions that are still dictating the way that this country is run. And so, you know, this stuff is in the DNA of this quote-unquote country called Australia. So I've also pulled a quote here, an audio quote from a woman named Emily Little, who this is from the Northern Territory Library Archives, from this project called Territory Stories, which is a bunch of recordings, basically, of people who were part of the Stolen Generation and them talking about their experiences. And I thought it would be good just to play a quote from her describing what the conditions were like at one of the places that she was forced to work at.
We used to get no mattress, only blankets to sleep on. We used to put, you know, all the stools up, and we used to sleep on those concrete floors. You know, two, three girls will get together. No pillows. We used to just sleep on blankets. To make enough blanket to go around the three of us, we used to, you know, she might have about four blankets, I'll have four, and the other one will have about four blankets. We used to all put it together so as we could be a bit more comfortable. That's how we used to do the sleep. But just rough concrete floors. And when we come to this home here, Telegraph, we were shocked to see beds and mattresses and coming into a mansion after sleeping on concrete floors.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, that's hard to listen to, but I think that, A, it's important to look this stuff in the face as settlers. But also, this is something that is still fucking being litigated in the mainstream media in this country. You've still got people going on primetime shows on Channel 7, people like Andrew Bolt insisting that Indigenous kids were removed from their families for their own good. Like, that is still a lie that is being perpetuated and so many people swallow.
And it's still happening as well. There's more Indigenous children being removed from their families now than there ever has been in this country's history. And
exactly,
it's still for the same bullshit reasons.
Look, it's horrible. And I'll get into, you know, I'll mention that a little bit further down in the segment as well. But so the Bringing Them Home report, which Sorry Day is marking, had 54 recommendations, and we've gone through this in some detail before in previous episodes. But so saying sorry was only one of those recommendations, really. And I'm just going to read here a summary of those recommendations that was put out by an organization called the Healing Foundation, which is an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organization that works with Indigenous communities to try and help people recover from trauma. They sum up the recommendations like this. So, an acknowledgement and formal apology with all parliaments, police forces, and churches to acknowledge, apologize, and make reparation for past wrongs. reparation for people who were forcibly removed, including monetary compensation, records, family tracing and reunion, including funding community-based link-up services to help families reconnect, rehabilitation for survivors of forcible removal, education and training, including a National Sorry Day, guarantees against repetition. I think that one is fucking crucial, including the implementation of self-determination approaches to the well-being of Indigenous children and young people, addressing contemporary separation, and a national process for coordination and monitoring the implementation of the recommendations. So we are still really, really behind, even on these recommendations, which, we've still got a really, really long way to go. And so it's not, I think, just a time for kind of reflecting and thinking about, oh, we did bad. It's a time for thinking about what we still owe, you know, what we still need to do. But as with, you know, a lot of these occasions, they become sort of milquetoast once they become mainstream, because obviously, you know, our governments can't acknowledge that they are completely illegitimate and that they perpetrating an ongoing genocide. It's just literally impossible for them to do that. And I wanted to read a quote here from Celeste Little. So that's Emily Little's granddaughter. And people would probably know her as a relatively well-known Indigenous activist and unionist. And she wrote this in Eureka. She wrote a piece about Reconciliation Week in Eureka Street. And she says, "I would swear that this week means nothing more to most people in this country than to call on the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in their workplaces and community to do more work. I wish it were a remembrance of these important dates and why there should be days which spark pride in the average Australian. But instead, it seems to be an opportunity to ask Indigenous folks what reconciliation means to us and then call on us to educate them on stuff they will then neglect to do for the next 12 months."
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's obviously very important that we are as proactive as we can be about directing our own learning about this. There is, the resources out there are innumerable. There is heaps and heaps. You know, you don't need to
endless like government inquiries and reports and so on. Even not touching the community recommendations and the
exactly
the black activists who are making what needs to happen known. Yeah,
yeah, and libraries, as I've mentioned, full of primary sources.
Yeah,
testifying about what happened. So there's, you know, there's heaps out there, and like, you know, I think Noon and I would both agree that we still have heaps and heaps to learn about this. But, you know, this is a time to recommit to that and put in the time and effort that is necessary. So as you mentioned, Noon, you know, it's very important to recognize that forced removals are still happening. So an estimated 17,664 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children were living in out-of-home care in 2017, compared with just over 9,000 10 years before that.
Wow.
So the rate like is doubled. Increasing. Yeah, the rate is increasing, and I haven't included any individual stories here because I don't know if we have the time
or
resources to do them justice, but I think that it's really important to look that up. I might put a link to an NITV article that I read in preparation for this segment that I think it's heartrending and really, really hard to read, but important to recognize, you know, how real this harm is still being done. But so just before we round out this segment, I wanted to recommend people look up and support Grandmothers Against Removals, who are really doing fantastic work around this. And they, if you go to their Facebook page, you can find them quite easily by searching them on Facebook, and they've got a link to donate to them. And, you know, I mean, that's an organization that really needs as much support as they can get around now. And that would be a great way, I think, to start trying to contribute as a settler.
Thanks for taking us through that, Zach. This week, our mains is mining mimosas, and we're as Zach already sort of said, we're going to talk more about First Nations issues, particularly in relation to mining. And so, Zach, maybe do you want to start us off with our blurst take for this week?
It was the best of
takes.
It was the blurst of
takes.
You stupid monkey!
Yes. Yeah, I mean, no.
You don't want to, but I mean,
no.
Do it anyway, please.
I was pulling up this quote before, and I sighed what might be the longest and most annoyed sigh of my life.
Yep.
Reading this quote from none other than Scott Morrison, so top dog taking out top spot this week in Blurst Take. He gave a press conference announcing the third in his little suite of job something policies. This one is called Job Maker, which is extremely catchy. It's still a little bit vague about what exactly JobMaker is going to look like, but essentially it seems to be about redirecting tertiary education to more skills-based training as opposed to university. So
I think part of that is also about dealing with like foreign students not coming over the next like months and years, so that they want to like reroute our tertiary education system to being a lot more like TAFE-y than uni-y. But also there's like reactionary anti-intellectual shit in that too, and all sorts of other things. But yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, having an excuse to gut the university sector even more is a big win for this government. There's other stuff in there, like they've flagged that there's going to be potential industrial relations reforms as well, which we're going to be keeping
heavy
an eye
on. Maybe
quotes
on reforms, but yes.
Yeah, reforms. Thank you. Necessary quotes. But when announcing this, Scott Morrison spoke more generally about five guiding principles of the job maker policy. And the second principle was, quote, caring for country, a principle that Indigenous Australians have practiced for tens of thousands of years. This involves responsible management and stewardship of what has been left to us to sustainably manage for current and future generations. We must not borrow from future generations what we cannot return to them. This is as much true for our environmental, cultural, and natural resources as it is for our economic and financial ones. Ugh. Governments must live within their means, not to impose impossible debt burdens on future generations. Sorry,
Shouldn't
have chuckled there because it's so dark, but watching Noon's increasing distress as that quote was read was enjoyable.
Fucking hell. I mean, like,
in the name of holy hypocrisy, that is just...
Caring for country means not having economic government
austerity.
Debt.
Yeah. Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, just the fucking gall... We must not borrow from future generations what we cannot return to them.
Oh,
like,
but we will fuck them with climate change, though.
Continue, or like...
And like,
we will continue to be the head of a state built on the very fucking concept of robbing future generations of Indigenous people of what could never be returned to them. Like, what?
I think, I mean, like, there's a lot of disgusting things about this take, but yeah, I think the thing that really upsets me the most about it is that he's just, like, picked a random Indigenous thing and been like, yeah, that means austerity, as you said. Like, I mean, he chose caring for country and there's literally no link between these two things except that he's decided that that's the title for his point that is austerity. And, like...
Yeah, and with the other also, hand, like... actively encouraging the continuation of fossil fuel
totally
mining and production.
And that's really what he's saying, is that like we need to keep doing this destructive extractive industry to pay off our debt because that's what caring for country is. Like,
it's really gross.
I will talk a bit more about mining in just a minute. But yes. So please keep this horrific take in mind, listeners.
Yeah, please. I think it's important context for what Noon is about to talk about.
Yeah.
And just before we move on, I just had to include this other quote from Morrison from that same press conference, because he was fucking on fire. I mean, props to the speechwriters. They really knocked it out of the park with this one. He also said, it is vital to get the Australian economy, quote, out of ICU and off the medication of government support before it becomes too accustomed to it.
Mm.
So love the analogy there of, like, putting the boot both into like people on welfare and people who use drugs or who need medicine to live. As we all know, the best way to get off welfare or to stop being sick is to just go fucking cold turkey from whatever it is that's keeping you alive.
Those people on medication, can't let them get accustomed to it.
You don't want to get accustomed to living. You don't want to get accustomed to eating. What was that line from Fury Road? Do not, my friends, become addicted to water. You will resent its absence. So yeah, congratulations to Scott Morrison on becoming the bad guy from what is arguably the best, greatest action film of all time. Moving on.
Yeah, so this story, this main segment is about mining and land rights. We've called it mining mimosas, but it's not as refreshing and delicious as a mimosa. It's much more like depressing and destructive.
I mean, I guess. Yeah, it's more like drinking ditch water.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a better... drinking ditch water, maybe that's a better...
It's not really a food pun as such. Anyway.
No.
But, yeah, I feel like this ties into the Sorry Day issue as well as that quote from Scott Morrison. I just wanted to start with this slightly out of context quote that I will explain, but this is from Rio Tinto, and they said, "We are sorry that the recently expressed concerns of the PKKP people did not arise through the engagements that we have taken place over many years under the agreements that governs our operations on their country." So, yes, I kind of have a bit of a loose theme of shitty apologies in this segment, and that's the first one, because on Sunday, Rio Tinto blew up two 46,000-year-old rock shelters, which were on Putu, Kunti, Kuruma, and Pinakura land, and those groups are referred to as PKKP people, and so their land is in the Pilbara in Western Australia. And in 2013, Rio Tinto was given ministerial consent to damage the Juukan Gorge caves. And 1 year later, an archaeological dig unearthed incredible artifacts like a 4,000-year-old plait of human hair and other evidence that this site was much older than originally thought. And according to the chair of UNESCO, it's like the destruction of Palmyra, which listeners may remember was a city in Syria, this like ancient cave city, and it was blown up by ISIS. And look, I'm not saying Rio Tinto or ISIS, but I'm also not saying that.
Rio Tinto is saying, oops, oh, a little mistake from us.
Well,
oh,
no.
They
didn't apologize for blowing it up. They apologized that the concerns of the people whose land they destroyed didn't come up in their engagements. And I will get
my
back
bad,
to the community engagement,
wow.
But they
really
definitely
like
didn't apologize for blowing up this unique, irreplaceable piece of cultural heritage and history.
Fucking hell. Strong dude called out for sexism on Facebook energy there in that apology.
100%. I'm sorry if you got emotional
offended.
Yeah.
By me blowing up your cultural history.
And so the PKKP people found out that these important caves were about to be blown up because they wanted access to it for NAIDOC week. And they called up Rio and were like, "Hey, we're just going to come onto this site." And Rio were like, "Oh no, you can't go in there. We're literally like about to blow it up like right now." They said it was imminent, but it can't have been that imminent because, and this is a quote from an AFP article, AFR article. "Mr. White confirmed that he was aware that the blasting was about to occur last week after his office was contacted by a concerned representative of the PKKP several days prior to the blasting. Mr. White said that representative was encouraged to pursue their concerns through the formal federal process." And so obviously that's super fucked that these people like went straight to the top guy. Ken Wyatt is the Minister for Indigenous Affairs, by the way. And they went up to him about this urgent, like days away issue and irreparable thing. And they were told like, "Oh yeah, just go through the normal channels. But then a few days later, they blew up these fucking 46,000-year-old shelters. And like,
maybe they filled out the wrong form.
Right. And there's no fucking form for like, don't blow up this shit, please.
Don't colonize my land for money.
And, you know, I've said unique, but probably our listeners already have a bit of an idea about this, but the way that land is tied into Indigenous culture is so intimate and they're like the same thing. You know, these areas, this place was intimately tied into the history and the present of PKK people. And there's just so many examples of this kind of destruction. And I don't have time to go into a lot of them, but one of them is in the Burrup Peninsula, also in Western Australia. There's more than 1 million pieces of rock art that have been found there, and they're being literally dissolved by sulfuric acid from a nearby gas mining and shipping hub. And the gas is just like leaking out into the air. The sulfur's leaking out into the air from this industrial process and like wafting across this priceless antiquity and destroying cultural heritage and knowledge. And like, one of the many fucked things about this whole situation is that it's entirely legal. And in especially the case of the Juukan Gorge, this explosion by Rio Tinto, it's very, very unlikely that any compensation is going to be made. And That's because Rio Tinto didn't do anything wrong from, like, a legal point of view. And I'll just really quickly go through this legal stuff. It's not super important. But there's a federal law, the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, that says you can't interfere with heritage-listed sites. But they don't list sites, so it's fine. And with Juukan Gorge, the evidence that it was a site of archaeological interest only came out after they'd been given this permission to start, like, damaging it. But, of course, that's evidence according to, like, white miners and the government, right? Like, presumably the PKK people knew that this 46,000-year-old dwelling and meeting place was important and might have mentioned not to blow it up. But as happened last week, when they say, please don't blow up our shit, it gets ignored. So, I mean, I imagine if they did try and at any point in the past 10 years be like, maybe don't blow up our shit, it was also ignored then. Anyway, so the federal government has basically been like, we don't give a fuck about this. It's not a heritage-listed site, so it gets sort of passed on to state law. And the state law does list these caves as a heritage area, and according to the Aboriginal Heritage Act of Western Australia, it's an offence to, quote, excavate, destroy, damage, conceal, or in any way alter any Aboriginal site without the consent of the minister. But, of course, the then Western Australia Minister for Mines, a guy called Bill Marmion, who's a Liberal, said it was fine to excavate, destroy, damage, conceal, or in any way alter these sites.
Oh, cool. So they're in the clear.
It's completely fine, apparently. Yeah. And so, yeah, there was that quote I said at the start about Rio Tinto saying they're sorry that these concerns didn't arise through the engagements that have taken place over many years.
Oh, my God.
But that means for 7 years, since 2013, when this ministerial thing was approved, they didn't ask the right people about whether or not it was fine to blow the shit up. Like, they apparently have some kind of community consultation process, but it seems to me like if they didn't discover that blowing these caves up was a problem, there's probably a lot of shit that they haven't discovered. And I have said this before on the show, but community consultation from, like, government and corporations is a complete fucking crock of shit. And it's always designed to avoid getting any input from the people being consulted. And I have... Yeah, I worked for a group called Lock the Gate. We were trying to stop onshore gas mining, and there was an extensive community consultation process that the Victorian state government implemented. And, like, we were well organized, and we went to all of the consultations, and we, like, did our best to, you know, make submissions and stuff. And we know, like, we were at literally every single thing. So we know every single person who submitted something. And by our numbers, roughly 97% of the people who attended were against the things that we were being consulted about. There were, like, I remember one guy being like, oh, you fucking hippies, I want gas mines on my farm. And we were like, okay, buddy, you can tell them that. It's okay. When the community consultation report came out, it was like, yes, approximately 40% of people had some concerns, and 10% said under no circumstances. And they had these, like, incredible ways, like, lists of keywords that had come up in the consultation, and they had just, like, clearly put a bunch of shit in that wasn't in the consultation process. Anyway, it's a bit of a rant, but I'm still angry about it all these years later. But
fair enough.
This, I think, yeah, the lack of consultation is just so, like, transparent. And I want to talk about... sorry, so many different issues combining into this. There's, like, centuries of colonial bullshit that contribute to this whole situation. But yeah. One big issue that's connected with all of this, which we've touched on a few times in this show, is about extinguishment of native title. And so this is a situation where the government basically says that the land has been so completely destroyed by colonizers that the connection that the traditional owners have with that land is functionally destroyed. And there's a lot of controversy about it, because on the one hand, it's, like, resulting in cash payouts that are really important and changing people's lives, like in Timber Creek and potentially the Noongar land in southern Western Australia. But on the other hand, it's, like, blood money for cultural genocide, and in many cases, the traditional owners don't actually want their title extinguished, because they want to have a continued, like, legal connection with the land. And one example of this is the Bungala people who are in South Australia, and they might have their title extinguished if the South Australian government decides to build a nuclear waste dump on their land.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and look...
But the logic of that is just so fucked. Like, we have ruined this so thoroughly that it is unrecognizable as the thing that you hold dear and important.
Totally.
Like, ugh.
Yeah. And, like, nuclear waste is a whole thing, and uranium mining and nuclear bomb tests, and there's a long history of nuclear technology being used to hurt and kill and maim Aboriginal people and communities. But, like, honestly, that's, like, a full mains at least. But I want to talk about this issue in connection with the native title thing. So a Senate committee found that the law in South Australia said that if they build the dump, the minister will be able to single-handedly approve expansion into Bungala sites that would then extinguish title, which is basically exactly what happened in Western Australia with this Rio Tinto thing with the PKKP people. The minister was like, oh yeah, fuck them. Do whatever you want. Blow that shit up. It's fine. And it's the same in South Australia. And so the government has provided, quote, no explanation, the report said, as to why the legislation only required a minister to notify parliament rather than require a vote on potential expansion. And the report also echoed Bungala native title holders' claims that they were not included in a community poll in which more than 60% of the people voted in favour of the proposal. Jason Bilney, chairman of the Bungala Determination Aboriginal Corporation, said he was told by then-Resources Minister Matt Canavan that a separate vote of Bungala people would be combined with the community vote. He did not put them together, so basically it was gerrymandering of the votes, Mr. Bilney said. If we were included, the result would have been different. And Matt Canavan said he, quote, never said that the ballots would be put together. I did promise that both ballots would be considered, which they have been. Which, like... This is exactly what I'm saying about community consultation always being designed specifically to avoid being like having to listen to the people being consulted, right?
Absolutely. It's something that's like installed as a process to make it look like there's some accountability.
Yes.
But of course, they completely undermine it. But then later on, they can say, no, we consulted the community.
We asked you and you said it was fine.
And that's all that needs to get mentioned about it.
Exactly. And so, like, if that is the kind of consultation.
It's just a fucking scam, an absolute grift.
Yeah. And if that's the kind of consultation that's, like, going on with this fucking waste dump, like, imagine what the community consultation that Rio Tinto is doing with the PKKP people. And as I said, like, we can tell from the outcome that the process didn't work, right? Like, we know that they didn't find out not to blow up this important heritage thing. Therefore, the community consultation must have been bullshit, okay? The South Australia thing also, the Bungala people are taking the case to the federal court for racial discrimination because they were basically like put in a different vote because they were black. So they're arguing that was basically segregation. And Mr. Bilney said, we're still treated like flora and fauna. If they push through legislation, it's basically taking away our native title rights. And to finish this up, I want to read, it's a quite a long quote, but again, as you said before, like, I think it's really important for us to center the voices of Aboriginal people in this and not just give our own takes, and like, I've given my own take, but like, yeah. So this is a longish quote from an article on Indigenous X, and the article is called Land Rights, A Sandcastle and a Windstorm by Natalie Crom, who's a Gamilaroi woman. And it's got a lot of relevance to what I've been talking about, how the whole system is organized specifically to let white people destroy Indigenous land and heritage, but it also ties into my theme of weak apologies. So,
perfect.
The struggle for land rights has been a long one, and one that has been fought hard and continues to be so. Why? Because the struggle continues. Every step in the direction of meaningful reform to address the issue of theft of this land is then countered through government legislation, and this mean-spirited response to every small victory we have has become emblematic of the Australian government. There are no shortage of examples of this greedy entitlement, but perhaps the most disgraceful example is the government response to the case of the Wik peoples versus the state of Queensland. And then she goes into some detail about the Wik case, which I won't read, but the short version is it was a very technical ruling that was officially in favour of the Wik people, but in practice wasn't what they wanted to hear because it basically still destroyed their native title rights. Yeah. She continues, at all times the Wik people conducted themselves with dignity. They used the colonial legal structures to affirm what was known at a cultural level in order to make the government see and understand that the Indigenous peoples of this country are not interested in land grab or commoditization of land. We want the non-Indigenous community to understand the responsibility of caring for the land, of belonging to it, and maintaining the synergistic relationship which gives life to our cultural communities and ceremonies. Instead, the government set out on a deliberate campaign to mislead the mainstream, as they termed everyone other than Indigenous people. The reason for the outcry from the political heavyweights was not the decision itself, because the cost was naught. It was no great victory for Indigenous people. It was no civil rights victory. There was no loss in a capitalist sense. But this was an extraordinary loss of face for the government, who were used to being in the driver's seat steering public opinion with respect to Indigenous people. This behaviour from John Howard, he has since reflected upon and said that he could have handled it better, but that it had, quote, unnerved us and, quote, I don't think I handled that next 6 months all that well. Understatement, but important when you consider that this is about as close to a mea culpa as you could get from a man famous for refusing to apologise and digging his heels in. Yeah, so anyway, I think that sums it up, you know, like, when there's any kind of small legal victory for Indigenous people, the government goes out of their way to undo it. And whenever they realize that they've done something destructive and awful, they can't even apologize for it properly.
Yeah, you might get a mealy-mouthed, like, oh, yeah, it made me uncomfortable, like 15 years later from the people who were directly responsible. That's about it. Fucking pathetic.
Do you want to just take us through the last bit of the story? Sorry, listeners, we are running a little over time this week, but I think it's been some good stuff.
Yeah, well, so this is kind of a more positive counterpoint, I guess, along the lines that you've been discussing, Noon. So why don't we play that positivity corner, Sting?
Positivity corner.
So listeners will hopefully remember the breakdown of Twiggy Forrest's fucked up bullshit career of being racist that we did on the show a couple episodes ago. And this is just a follow-up on one of the stories that we spoke about in that segment. So his company, Fortescue Metals Group, has just officially lost its high court bid against the Native Title determination. So Fortescue Metals Group, or FMG, which is Forrest's company, was contesting the native title of the Yindjibarndi people in the Pilbara, which I pronounced Pilbara incorrectly several times last time I spoke about it, so thank you for that correction, Noon. So that's land which contains this multi-billion dollar Solomon Hub mining project, which FMG was mining that land without the permission of the Yindjibarndi Aboriginal Corporation. So this conflict has been ongoing since 2003, when the Yindjibarndi people initially applied for exclusive native title, meaning that they could decide who gets to come onto their land and what they get to do on it. That was awarded in 2017, and they've been in court with FMG since then, going back and forth on appeals and stuff. But this decision now is final. It means that the Yindjibarndi Aboriginal Corporation, or YAC for short, can now pursue compensation for economic loss and spiritual harm that was done by FMG mining on their land without their permission. And that compensation, it's predicted, could likely be in the millions of dollars. So the chief executive of YAC is a man named Michael Woodley, and he said, "This is a real jubilant moment today. We can rest easy now, knowing this is the end. We can give the next generation some hope from this point forward." So, I mean, he's been on the front line of this for 17 years, really, this battle. So it's you know, absolutely mammoth, and the fact that they've gotten this ruling in their favor is fantastic, and a little shining light, I suppose, in the broad darkness that you have just painted the picture of, Noon. So that claim is probably going to take a few years to put together, I mean, look, I think it's just very important to note that there is a certain amount of, like, anonymity granted, I think, to businesses and corporations. We talk about Rio Tinto, we talk about FMG executing this stuff, but at the end of the day, there are executives behind these companies who are personally fucking responsible for their actions. And in the case of FMG, we've got quite a publicly well-known face behind this, Andrew Forrest, aka Twiggy, who, you know, as we've gone into detail about, is a fucking racist. Somebody who is very, like, anti-welfare, very pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of guy. Last year, he told FMG shareholders that compensating the Yindjibarndi people would be mining welfare.
Jesus Christ.
And as we discussed earlier, you know, he famously made a whole bunch of racist comments about the people of Roeburn, which is the town kind of where a lot of Yindjibarndi people live, and making these awful comments about young women selling themselves for cigarettes and that kind of thing. And, you know, there was a complaint to the Human Rights Commission made by a bunch of women, Yindjibarndi women, about his comments. So, you know, he's got form for this. And I just think it's important that, like, I don't know, that companies and governments don't get to sort of hide behind this facade of like, no, it's a corporation that's doing this. No, there are like individual people who represent the tip of the spear of colonization and exploitation and the extractivist attitude that has fucked over the indigenous people of this land. So Noon, can you see, do you have the notes up there?
I do, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, could you just read the last line?
Sure. Okay, so this is a quote from the hosts of a show called Auspol Snack Pod, Australia's foremost political nobodies, right? And it goes like this. Andrew Forrest can suck shit. He is a racist wanker who profits from the dispossession of Indigenous people while pretending to be their white saver. Fuck Twiggy forever! Yeah, that's a good quote. Whoever said that must have been clever and insightful and
those political nobodies are quite on top of it. So, look, that is definitely a really positive outcome to that story. It's been a long and difficult fight for the Yindjibarndi people. But as you say, Noon, you never know what the government is going to throw at them next. So, look, more power to them. And I'm sure that money will be extremely fucking transformative for that community. And, you know, I can't wait to hear. I hope there's more good news coming out of that soon.
So I know you just played the positivity corner sting, Zach, but I feel like it might also be relevant to our next segment. But in fact, our next segment is a potluck. Normally, we ask people to record themselves talking for a minute about some Auspol or shitposting related thing and sending it in to us at auspolsnackpot@gmail.com. But this week, we have something a little bit different, Zach.
Yeah, we do. Why don't we play that? Now.
Potluck, where you bring the snacks.
Hey Zach and Noon, thank you for a great show. Please record more. Love you.
Hey Zach and Noon, thank you so much for making this podcast for us. I always learn so much, and I just want to say on the record that I think your food puns are shit puns, not shit puns. Thanks, guys.
Hey, fellas. Congratulations on your 50th show. Top effort. Love, Ethan.
Thanks, guys. We really appreciate all the hard work that you put into these shows each week and all the bonus episodes and all that kind of stuff. Really appreciate the effort that you put into amplifying the voices of marginalised communities. Thanks, guys.
Hey, Zach and Noon. Just wanted to say thanks for all the snacks, and you're both very good eggs. Here's to another 50 episodes.
Hi, Zach and Noon. Congratulations on 50 episodes. Hope you'll have me back on soon so I can slag off neoliberalism.
Hi, Zach. Hi, Noon. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Just want to say congratulations on the big 5-0. Love you.
Noon, Zach, Lana here, and wowee, 50 whole episodes of Auspol Snack Pod. What an amazing achievement. Thanks so much for keeping me learned on all things Auspol, and yeah, keep it up.
Thank you, Zach and Noon, for the sustenance.
Oh, that's too fucking cute. It's literally too cute. That is the sweetest
news.
Thing.
Our supporters and listeners are the largest cuties
that's true.
Of all time. I got that email last night from Leah. Thank you so much, Leah, for presumably organizing that and sending it through. And it was Friday. It was TGI Friday, you know? And I had a few beers. And when I have a few beers, I tend to get a little bit emotional. I definitely cried immediately when
Me
I started
too.
Listening
yeah,
to
yeah.
that. That is just...
Oh, my gosh.
That's like ridiculously amazingly sweet. And thank you, everybody who contributed to that and who continues to listen to and support this show. I mean, it just, yeah, that's an unbelievable thing to have.
Yeah.
To feel, to know from people. Yeah, bit speechless. Look, amazing. And
about half an hour before we got that in our email, I just put up a post on Ozpol Shitposting being like, oh, we're trying to get to 50 reviews before we record tomorrow. And then I listened to that and I was like, oh my God, I really don't need to like scrounge for these like desperate reviews. But we did actually get 6 new reviews last night, which is super lovely. We were trying to get to 50 before our 50th episode and we got up to 53, which is so nice. And so as we do, we're like miles over time this week, but I did want to read at least some of those reviews. Do we have time to do all of them?
Look, I thought maybe we could just shout the people out and say, sure, thank you. Yeah.
So thank you to Holly and to Liam, who said this podcast is hosted by two liberal Muslim homosexuals, ACLU law professors and abortion doctors who make podcasts about Karl Marx,
a known atheist.
And that one goes on a lot longer, but I liked that intro. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, John E. And La Tech, and also Kernis. And also
Mac
on a different platform, but thank you for letting us know that you left a review there. We found it and it's very nice.
And it's extremely sweet. Yeah.
Maybe we can like spread these reviews out over the next couple of weeks. If we don't get more, we can start reading them out in the fall. But thank you to everyone who did them. We did see them and we love them. It's really nice. Thank you all.
Yeah, it's incredible. Honestly, we're both extremely moved by this.
Grateful and yeah.
For real. Lovely. Honestly, I still feel somehow like a fraud that I get to do this and that people listen and enjoy and let us know that. Like, I don't know. It feels like cheating or something. I can't quite explain it, but it just honestly, it really means so much to us that you enjoy the show and you continue to support us. So thank you so much, everybody. We really appreciate your support and tuning in this week. As mentioned, there are bonus episodes which you can access if you want to support us on Patreon for as little as $1 a month.
We just had one come out this week, and I think it's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. How does a bill become law? How does a bill become law? Beyond that, yeah, you know, if you haven't, we always appreciate a good review, especially on Apple Podcasts. It helps us out. And sharing us on your socials. We're on Twitter and we're on Insta, we're on Facebook.
Or text a friend who is kind of interested in Ozpol or memes and suggest that they give us a listen.
Never know what could happen. Let them know that we're Australia's foremost political nobodies.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, that probably about does us for this week. Is that all you had to say, Noon?
There was one other thing.
Oh, yeah?
Crunch, crunch.
Oh. We'll keep on snacking in the free world. Okay. 50 episodes and we still can't get the sign off right. We'll get them next time.